Gosha from Cosmic Agency. Hola, soy Gosha de Agencia Cósmica. This interview will be done in English, but don't worry, please activate the subtitles because, yes, this interview will be subtitled, is subtitled, if you're already watching it. Hello, Dale. We are with Dale. Hello.
Hey, how are you? It's an honor to be with you.
I am very good, thank you. I'm very excited to be talking to you today. And I would like to make a short introduction about Dale. I mean, who is Dale? Because normally I don't do interviews with people, so this has to be an unusual guest, right? If he is appearing on my channel. Well, Dale actually has contacted me and we started talking about Varu's messages. We'll go into that a bit later, but first let me just make a short introduction. Your full name is Dale Harder, right?
It's William Dale, but I go by Dale.
Okay, perfect. And you are a scientist, you are an engineer, and from what I understand, you worked for NASA for 12 years?
Correct.
You are also a laser electro-optics specialist, and you own two companies.
Yes.
You worked in aerospace center. Correct.
Yes.
So your curriculum is quite impressive.
Honeywell Aerospace, yes.
Okay, Honeywell, yes, I have that here, exactly. Honeywell Aerospace Center aircraft. And you have been interested in the UFO subject for all your life, basically, but professionally for about 43 years. Yes, you have been investigating the UFO field for 43 years, and this includes also being a member of Cleveland Ufology Project, which I have here the information, it's supposedly the oldest UFO club in the world.
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Very exciting, very impressive. And also, and probably the most importantly, he claims to be a Taygetan Pleiadian incarnated here at this time on Earth to help with that transition process, and he has synchronized very well with Varu's messages, and this is what we will be talking about. This is really very, very, very exciting because you are a scientist, you are an engineer, you worked for NASA, among many, many other things. So you have the technical mind, and you are still able to grasp a lot of very spiritual, metaphysical concepts that Varu shares, which corroborates for me and validates her message. So that's why it was so important for me to interview you. So thank you very much for agreeing, because I understand when you contacted me, you didn't mean the interview. You just wanted to share what we know,
exactly.
You know, and talk as kind of a kin souls, right? And so I would like you to start and tell me first about who you believe yourself to be. You can talk about your Pleiadian connection there.
Okay, I can give you the story or the intro. The way that I came, I have memories of a time before I was born into a physical body, but I had volunteered to leave my home in the Pleiades and join a kind of a vanguard force, if you will, of individuals that volunteered to come to Earth some 60 years or more ago. And we were the beginning star seeds to basically help with the ascension process. So I went through the training and the processes to prepare to come to Earth. And, we go through a selection process whereby human physical mother and father are chosen, and a baby or a body is chosen, and then we make arrangements with those souls and people to enter. And I can remember the time, it was kind of like we were on the spaceship, actually, and we're above Earth, we're getting ready, all of us, to enter into our chosen physical forms, and we have to be in a physical form or go through the birthing process so that we can stay on Earth in a low 3D frequency level for a long period of time. If we were just visiting for a short period of time, as our brothers and sisters do occasionally, then they don't necessarily have to change, but they can't stay that long. it's a complete mismatch of frequency. So it is difficult on either or. In any case, so it was my turn to basically leave the craft and to make the jump. And at that point, I got very scared. And I decided, I said, no, I can't do this. I'm not going. And I just couldn't go. It was like a parachuter trying to jump out of a plane and too scared. And my brothers and sisters are going, no, you volunteered. You have to go. And they pushed me out, literally. And so I ended up in the physical form. And I was born into a young baby's body, of course, through the standard birthing process. After that, I literally was left basically on a doorstep in a basket kind of thing. I was 3 months old and given for adoption. And so I was very fortunate that the mother and father that adopted me, they were recently married. We were 21 and 20 and 21. And my mother had some complications and could not have children. So they decided they were going to adopt. They went to the Catholic Charities organization, and they interviewed different babies and so forth. And my father told me, he says, that they picked me up. He was holding me, and I smiled at him, and I put my head on his shoulder, and I fell asleep. And instantly, my father said, "This is the one." So that's how I got adopted. I had a sister that was adopted 4 years later in the same fashion. So, you know, I began my life that way.
So you don't remember, well, you don't have any information about your biological parents?
No. No, the only thing that I have that I'm related to in any way is my daughter. I have a daughter who's 33.
Now, let me just go back a second. You talked about the training. You remember, you have a memory of being up there and having received the training.
Right.
Do you remember anything about that training?
Not exactly, no. I don't remember a great deal about my family or the Palladian life and so forth. There's some bits and pieces. And, of course, I've had many people say, well, geez, that's odd. Why don't you remember everything? Yeah, it's like I said, so sometimes we do not have full recognition or memory of all of the things that we're going through. So, and we do that on purpose.
Yes. What do you think the purpose is?
Sometimes I think if we remembered, had full recognition or remembrance of, say, if I remembered my wife, my children, my home, different things like that, it might be very difficult if I would miss them. It might interfere with what I have to do here. So there are times I think that partly we choose not to remember everything. But we do come through with enough to remember where we were and what we did in most cases. You know, I came through with enough of that. And essentially the weird part of it is for me, when I was born, I had essentially a full knowledge. Everything that I basically know as an adult, I knew then, but I didn't know what it meant. I had to grow into it. I had to experience it to fully understand it. So it's been a lifetime of learning what that information was. And so it's been quite a lifetime.
You identify yourself now as a Taygetan play alien. So I would like you, because that's very specific. I would like you first to maybe share with us how you came to the realization that you're a Pleiadian, not many, so many races out there. Why not Andromedan? Why not Arcturian? And then within the Pleiades, why Taygetan? And also you said you came to the realization what planet it is. You mentioned which planet?
Yes. Well, I can tell you that... I was raised on a farm in Tennessee, a very large plantation, and I also was raised between there and Cleveland, Ohio. And during the time, in each case, as a very young child, I would lay out in the field and look at the stars at night. But in any case, I would look at the stars at night, and when I would look at the Pleiades, I always had this sense of home, this sense of longing. And I knew from day one that I wasn't from here, but, you know, it was hard. How could I tell anybody that? They wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
At a very young age, I mean, I'm 4 or 5 years of old age, and I'm running around the house, I'm telling my parents, you know, that I knew that I wasn't going to be here very long. I essentially was supposed to have a mission of about 40 years. And so I knew that I wasn't going to be here very long. And I would tell them things like that, and they just look at me and go, what? You know, they didn't quite understand. They knew I was different. I knew I was different. And, you know, so they did their best to try and humor me or understand, if you will. And, you know, so as time went on, more and more came out. And so at the age of 6, I was repairing all of the appliances and televisions and the electronics of the neighborhood for people. They would bring them to me and I would fix them. At the age of 6 and a half, I built my first laser. It was a ruby laser. And then a few years later, I built a gas laser, and I won science fairs and projects with it. And I built rockets and Tesla coils and everything. I had a complete laboratory in my parents' home when I was a little boy, tiny. And so from that time on, so, you know, it was kind of different. I idolized Tesla. And I emulated him and followed in his footsteps, essentially. So, you know, they knew I was different. The other children were scared to death of me. Nobody wanted to play with me. I had psychic abilities, empathic abilities, and I was attracted to light, and I was very temperature sensitive. I loved animals and trees and plants and crystals. And, you know, I was attracted to all these things, and I didn't always know why, but I knew I wasn't from Earth. And I would also tell my parents that I knew that I was here to help mankind, humankind. And they said, what? I said, yeah, well, you know, I just would say that. And they finally got used to the idea. But so the story goes from there.
So that was your Pleiadian association, and then how did you reach to the Tai Geta and your planet Era? I understand, right? You said Era.
Right. Yeah. It was something that kind of always stuck in the back of my mind. I always heard Era, and I didn't know exactly what that meant as a child, but you know, later on in life, I heard what it was. And as you know, in the Pleiadian system of the seven sisters, one of the planets or the star is called Electra.
Yeah.
And actually, Electra used to sit on my right shoulder as one of my guides. Okay. And then I also had contact with various others that were around me at all times, and their names corresponded to the other stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, of course, I learned about the Pleiades in school and everything and what that really meant. But, you know, I had all of these inner feelings and already knew. So it was pretty interesting. Now, then the psychic abilities and things like that, that scared most children. They knew I was different and they didn't want to be around me. And it used to hurt me because being an empath, I could feel all of their feelings. I could feel and hear their thoughts. I had to be taught how to block all the thoughts out because it was like 1,000 radio stations at one time. So it was quite a process. But I was not unhappy, and I actually enjoyed being alone. I was alone. And I think, as you and I talked, that's something that you can relate to as well. So it's nothing for me even today. When I worked, I used to work 16-hour days in a building by myself with no windows and had no problem with that. So.
Okay. Just to understand this part a little more about the Era connection. So you always felt this word in you, Era, but you didn't know, you couldn't associate. So it was later you found the books, you found the information about Era, and this all came together, clicked?
Then I knew instinctively at that point that was it, that was what it was. You know, the same way that I would lay there. It was like the movie E.T., and he would say, phone home, and I would just lay there and go, home, home, you know. And it was almost pathetic, But that's the way it felt, you know, and I couldn't get out of that. I couldn't get away from it.
Now, when you said, when you said you came in with the full knowledge, and you since the young baby in a child, you had this full knowledge.
Yeah.
Are you referring to the scientific knowledge? Because then you said at six you started to repair things and create things. You mean technical knowledge, or you mean spiritual, metaphysical knowledge?
Everything.
Everything.
Everything. I will share only for the sake of sharing.
Okay.
But currently, I have more than 17 fields of proficiency and schooling and so forth in different areas. So I've had a knowledge of and abilities like not only the spiritual but the historic or shall we say history, science, engineering, physics, everything. It was always there. But I had to learn what all of that meant.
Okay. You didn't have the context to understand all this information. And now you also said you came in, you had this memory of coming for a 40-year contract.
Right.
So what happened? I'm assuming, I'm only assuming, maybe I'm wrong, that you are more than 40 years old. So you are still here. So what happened in the meantime?
Well, you know, I truly love this planet. I love the human race. I love humanity. And I really, truly wanted to stay and to serve. My entire purpose being here is to serve. And I said, well, I'm here. I would like to stay and serve. And I would tell my brothers and sisters that. And, you know, they said, well, you can stay, but there would be consequences. And, you know, they said that because I would stay longer, that this physical body would suffer. And I said, okay, I'll deal with that as I have to. Well, as I got a little older, and I'd never been sick in my life, really, up until about 50. And after that, I just simply got sick. It forced my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still run the two companies, but I don't have to do a lot of physical work and report like I would on a normal daily job with NASA and others. And my body is suffering dearly, and I have certain ailments that prevent me from having the great life, as it were, but I'm still here and still functional, and I'm beating it. I'm going to beat it.
Yes.
But it's my choice to stay, and so there were consequences for that.
Very good. I have to ask, when you said they said that I can be here, but with the consequences, what do you mean they said? Just to clarify for the audience, do you have a physical contact? Do you talk with them telepathically? Was it just a feeling?
No, it's more based on telepathic and feelings. I would get senses as well as sometimes voices, literally, that would talk to me. And, you know, so that even goes back to the very early childhood of me seeing craft ever since I was a child. I've seen spacecraft or spaceships, whatever you want to call it, ever since I can remember. Probably my earliest remembrance that I have a real firm memory of is about 6-7 years of age.
Yes, I want to talk to you about your crafts, because you see so many, Dale has so many stories about the UFO sightings and all kinds of interesting events happening. But before that, you mentioned that you had the feeling that you could stay more than 40 years. I just want to share with you, there's something personal also, something interesting that actually kind of validates your experience, and your experience validates mine, that a few years ago, before turning 40, because I'm actually 41 right now, a few years ago, before turning 40, I had this very, very, very realistic dream. We all know how those feel. It was not a dream. It was like so real. So in that dream, I remember being taken on a ship. But before I was on the ship, I cruised over a certain frequency field, and now I understand it's Van Allen belts, probably the frequency change from the 3D to 5D. But it felt like it was coming from the water, you know, like the substance, the consistency of the fluid that surrounds your body changes. So when you are in the water and then you come out of the water, like you feel lighter. So this is how it felt. So I came from that. I passed through that field, through that belt, and I heard people asking me this question. Are you you want to continue or you want to come back? And I said, I remember I looked through the window. It was a huge window. And I looked at the earth. It was like a big earth in front of me. And I looked at the earth and I felt so much love toward the humanity and toward the earth itself and toward the cause. So I remember I looked at the earth and I said, no, I'm going back. I'm going back. And they said, are you sure? I'm sure. I'm going back. And it was just before I turned 40. So it's just interesting that you said that you had a 40-year contract.
Yeah. I'm getting tingles right now.
Yes. Yes. And I don't have many, I don't have actually any, almost any memories, but this was something that is, that just, I know it wasn't a dream. It happened. It was a memory. It happened. Now, you mentioned the crafts. Yeah, let's just mention the crafts that you see, because as my audience knows, some do, some don't. Actually, I don't see any UFOs almost ever. And so as you see, everybody has different experiences happen to them in their life, and the contact can happen in many different ways. I don't see UFOs. I don't see the orbs. I don't see the lights in the sky. I don't have crop circles appearing in my garden, but Dale is full of those stories. I mean, and he keeps a great, great report of every single sighting he has. So tell us something about that, please.
Well, like I said, I've been seeing them all my life. I'll tell you briefly the first one. Like I was about 6.5, 7 years of age, somewhere in that range. For those that remember the old-time lawnmowers that had a spiral blade and you used to push them. Okay, my father had two. He had a big one and a small one. So I was actually out in the yard, and I was one of my chores, as weekly chores, was to cut the grass and to take out the garbage and different things. For those that most people these days don't remember, children working for an allowance, getting 50 cents a week, but we did.
Yeah.
So I washed dishes and what have you, you know. But I was out there trying to cut the grass, pushing this rotary mower. And it's in the afternoon. It's a bright, sunny day. There's no clouds in the sky. And as I'm pushing, I believe that I'm moving in an easterly direction. And I had a feeling that I was being watched. And so I looked around and I didn't see anything, and I had the feeling to look up. And as I looked up, above me there were three saucers, silver saucers. They were in the positions of an equilateral triangle, one at each point, 1, 2, 3. And as I would walk, they would move. And if I would stop, they would stop. And so I just looked and watched and looked and watched and went about my business mowing grass. But it never bothered me. I never felt nervous or upset or scared. And then after a certain point, they all just took off and they were gone. And so throughout my entire life, I had these kind of things happen to me. And even though inside, I knew that I was different, I knew I wasn't from here, I don't think that on the level that we live every day in 3D, that I fully accepted that. There were people throughout my lifetime that would come up to me that I'd never seen before. I could be in a mall, I could be in a store, I could be in a restaurant, anything, and they'd walk up to me and say, "You're not from here." And I said, "Pardon me?" They said, "You're not from here." They knew I wasn't from here, and they would tell me, "No, but these were people that were psychic or they were gifted in some fashion," but they knew. And they would tell me this, and I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, thanks." You know, and I just kind of brush it off. Not until I was actually 56 years of age did I fully accept who I was and what I was. And I finally said, you know, it's about time I accept this. And that's when I started really going public with everything that I'd always told people my whole life, but I wasn't pursuing it as a mission.
Okay.
And so I accepted it, and then everything went crazy. So, but as far as the ships coming and going, yeah, I've seen every manner of ship in every shape, physical and non-physical. And our brothers and sisters come, I believe, most often in what we call a light ship. It's those beautiful, big, brilliant orbs that can be different colors, but most often they're kind of white.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go out here at the home and I literally just sit for 5 minutes and meditate and ask them to come, they come. And they'll come very close. And I live in the city,
mm-hmm.
or in the suburbs anyway, and they come very, very close to the house. So, you know, many people I have invited here who are skeptical, and I'll call the ships and they come, and when they see them, they just can't believe it. And as I was talking to you, I learned that apparently there are times when they go away and they're absent for a few months on end, or even maybe 4 or 5 months. It appears that in my records and yours that our times almost coincide as to when Swaru was talking to you, and I was not seeing them as well. So I kind of wonder if it wasn't even them in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been interesting.
Yeah. I wonder what would happen if I joined you for one of those meetings, because I tend to scare away all the UFOs. When I come, nothing appears.
Remember what I told you. You're going to see one really soon.
Yeah, I keep your word. Let's see what happens. Now, I would like to ask you now about why exactly you contacted me, and what attracted you in Svaru's messages, and we can go into that. But before that, just to appease people's curiosity, because for sure they are going to be asking and thinking, can you just tell us more or less what you did at NASA? What did you do at NASA exactly? What was your job?
Well, even though I was an engineer and had other capabilities, I went to work for them in like January of 1980, and I was not hired to be an engineer for them. I was actually hired to be an electronics specialist, and so I went to work as an electronics specialist, and that was repairing equipment, calibrating equipment, and doing various things on the base for the purpose of testing new rocket engines, new jet engines, and various stuff like that. So I spent a number of years working through the levels of a third grade to a second grade to a first grade technician. And after that, I left the technical aspect, and I was promoted into management, middle management. And I was trained as a metrologist. And that is a specialist in the science of measurement for the National Bureau of Standards, or in this case, it's now called NIST. All right. So I would work in the laboratories and maintain standards to which all other electrical things were measured against. Now that means like the resistance unit is an ohm, and we maintain the 1 ohm resistance standard. There are electrical standards. There were standards for weight, for pressure, for vacuum. I maintained all of those standards, and I would test all the pieces of equipment on the base to make sure that they were calibrated, give them my official stamp, and then they could be used to do the job of working on the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a senior member of a two-man team that oversaw the entire NASA Lewis, or now NASA Glenn, it became Glenn. When I was working there, they oversaw the entire base. And that was about, as I recall, about 256,000 pieces of equipment. So we did some purchasing, we did some recommending, we did the calibrations, etc. I also had other jobs that I did for them. I worked on the shuttle, and I worked on the Atlas Centaur and Atlas Agena rockets.
Wow.
And I was sent to Kennedy to work on the shuttle, and I also went to Houston.
Amazing.
And I was trained in all of those things.
Now, how did it feel working at NASA and working with all these scientists and all these scientific projects, being a Pleiadian soul inside? How did you feel?
I don't think my Pleiadian part ever bothered me. You know, I liked working there. I liked doing the things that I was doing with the science and the engineering and all that, because for me, it was kind of a way to get closer to space, if you will, And I've always wanted to get my own spacecraft and get off of this mud ball, at least for a while. But, you know, so it was a way to do that. But I never had any trouble with my so-called Pleiadian app asserting itself that, you know, it would give me any trouble there or not.
Because I'm thinking you came in with all this knowledge, as you said, and I imagine it's you were referring to that to the knowledge of your Pleiadian heritage. And then, as we know, the scientists in many ways are very limited in their ways of looking at reality. So I was wondering if that caused you any clash between the scientist worldview and your own inner worldview of how things work.
No, I think because I tend to be. And you'll forgive this, I tend to be more of a leader than a follower.
Okay.
That the projects that I headed up or worked on, I was generally the one in charge, so I kind of got to do as I saw fit.
That makes sense.
But that did not mean that I could not work as a team player, which I often did. But I do have a strong personality, and, you know. But in any case, if anything, my foreknowledge allowed me to make choices that would often help rather than hinder a project or progress.
Mm-hmm.
So I relied on that heavily. That was just part of who I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And interestingly, I also know that you actually wanted to be an astronaut for a while, but then you were too tall.
Yes.
Or something. I didn't know.
I wore glasses. Yeah. From the time I was about 6 years of age, I wore glasses.
Okay.
And that was one thing in the early days that you could not do as an astronaut. They kind of felt that if your glasses floated off while you were up there, it might be a problem.
That makes sense, yeah.
There was a height requirement. 5'6", I believe, was the maximum height in the early days. And I'm 5'10", and I was tall as a teenager.
Yeah.
So that prevented my opportunities there. But then, you know, later on, of course, they changed those restrictions, and I had the opportunities, but by then I was too old to do the astronaut program.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe it turned out for the better, you know? And now I would like you to know, I would like to tell me, so now let's talk about this. So why did you contact me exactly? What triggered you in watching? How did you find the videos about Baru's messages and a lot of, because I don't actually have in my English channel, I don't have so much published yet. You know, between me and Robert's channel, we have a lot in the Spanish version, but in the English channel, it's not so active yet. So how did you find us, and why did you contact me exactly?
Well, it's kind of like this. When in my life, when I get to the point where I am asking the right question, the answer is usually provided in some fashion. And I have been telling my people that I wanted to talk to them. I wanted to see them. I wanted to, in other words, I needed like a family reunion. Like sometimes you just want to sit down with your family and have some potato salad and relax, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe have a beer or something or a cup of coffee. And I've been telling them, you know, I've been doing this down here alone for a while, and I'd like to, you know, meet up with you and chat for a while. But in any case, I was doing my usual research, and all of a sudden it popped to me that you should look at this channel. And, of course, it was your channel, Cosmic Agency. And I started looking at that, and the first time I saw you and listened to you, I was absolutely drawn. It was like, I know you. I knew I would have bet almost anything you were Pleiadian, and I would have bet almost anything that you know, that you were someone I needed to know and talk to. And then as I would listen to you, and I'd be like the dog or the cat, and I was just swaying to watching your news and your information. And I'm going, wait a minute, I know that. Wait a minute, I knew that when I was a child. Oh, that's something else. And there were just thing after thing after thing, and I just, this is somebody I absolutely have to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a chance and I reached out to you, and you responded, which is something you said you don't even usually do.
Yes,
so
true.
I kind of get the feeling it was supposed to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, we receive so many emails, and I try to respond sometimes, you know, I try to respond, but sometimes it's not possible technically for me, because generally, and I have to apologize, it's difficult for me to talk on through email and chat. I don't know, I find it very draining. And then if I have to go through also, so anyway, that part. I responded, yeah, it was like something intrigued me about you. So just the fact that we are speaking now could be a validation for what you were feeling, you know, and you giving me now this interview could also be a validation for whatever. I don't know.
I believe, Gosha, that it really is, that it,
yeah.
it truly is. In all humbleness, I've been in this so long. I've worked with or know most of the people in the UFO industry or field, some are personal friends and otherwise, but in all of the time that I've been involved in this, there's only been one other person in my whole life that I ever felt that kind of attraction to, and I was very sure that she's Palladian also. It was a woman that I met at one of the Contact in the Desert conferences. And I went full well knowing that I was going to meet someone. That was the reason I went. It wasn't because I needed to hear all the information. I already knew what they were going to say. So I went for that purpose. And I actually had my arm in a cast from a very serious operation that I'd had. And I was going, if I had to crawl on broken glass, I was going. So that's how I met this individual. But that's been a number of years. And then all of a sudden I saw you and I said, wait a minute, there's that feeling again, but you're even stronger than the other one.
Yeah.
And the connection. And then I found that you were talking to Svaru and Rochelle and Annika.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, you know, as well as the confirmations of speaking with Asket and Samyasi.
Oh no! With Samyasa, no, we didn't speak. We spoke to Asket. Yes, Asket.
I was involved with Billy Meyer in the early days, and I truly believe that Billy Meyer had actual contact.
Yes.
In the early days.
Yes.
But I will tell you my personal opinion now is that ever since the Samyasi Star Center was formed. And the group called FIGU or FIGU,
yes.
I believe that they've more or less turned it into a circus and it's not what it should be. So I have my doubts about that. But the beginning with Billy was real.
Well, let me just tell you something. I can confirm everything what you're saying, actually. I asked it and the team, the Tiger and team, they actually confirmed to us that the contact was real. They definitely
yeah.
contacted Billy Meyer. And Asket came the second first. It was Samyasa, but then she had an accident, and then Asket took over. And then you know it was real in the beginning. But what happened then? People started to adore them. I'm not talking about Billy Mayer. I'm talking about the girls.
Yeah.
And Asket
yeah.
told us that there was one situation when she came down and she came out of the house, Billy Mayer's house. And there was a group of people with roses, with flowers, kneeling down as to the gods. You know, they were perceiving them as goddesses. And this
yes.
was, and Asket told us this was the last day I spoke to Billy Meyer because he didn't transmit well enough that they don't want to be seen as goddesses. That this is not, you know, they are not angels. They are not above us. They are our brothers and sisters. And
exactly.
And after that, what happened? They told us. The Billy Meyer started to add parts of the story from his own imagination. So now we have a mix of the truth and some invented information. And interesting, you mentioned the Samyasa's Silver Star Center, because actually a few weeks ago, something told me to contact them because I was thinking maybe we can contact Billy Meyer. I mean, if this is real, he would be really excited. So there was no way of contacting him directly, but I went through the center, and a man responded to me. I don't remember his name, and he kind of abused me. He said, you know, you are delusional. This is, you know, of course I'm not gonna, because I asked him, please forward this YouTube channel to Billy Meyer. That's all I was asking.
Right.
And he said, of course, I'm not going to do that. You are delusional, ridiculous. So, of course, I was ready for that. I was expecting this reaction because, for sure, there are so many people who are contacting Pleiadians and Tigetans and Asket, channeling.
Yes.
So I understand in a way, you know, but that was his reaction. So no access to Billy Meyer.
Unfortunate, but but not unexpected.
Yes, that was my reaction. Unfortunate, but not unexpected.
See, and as you say, there's so many that are trying to contact the Palladians, but I do not trust channeling, for one.
Me neither.
I very rarely trust that. And so when I started listening to your material, and I felt that it wasn't channeled or anything, I could relate to most of the things, because they were things I knew my whole life but couldn't tell anyone.
Next question again, then. So please tell us, what is it in Svaru's messages that confirms to you that this is real, that validates for you that this contact is real? Because so many people ask us, how do we know this is real? What evidence do we have? And we made a video in a Spanish channel about why can there be no evidence? Maybe one day I will do it in English. But now, your point of view, what can validate to you, what validated to you that this is for real?
Well, imagine this. A five-year-old running around the house telling his parents that I always knew that if I could change my frequency of vibration and that I could vibrate at the same frequency, for example, as another star, say Alpha Centauri, that I would instantly be where Alpha Centauri is. And they would look at me like, what, are you out of your mind? But I see, I knew this. And it was simply a matter of frequency and not space travel or pushing gas out of the end of an envelope, if you will, to achieve speed. That's one way of doing it, but it's not going to work for space travel. In any case, I mean, I'm 5 years old and I knew this, right? So when I heard her talk about frequency and so forth, especially when navigating in the ships and their propulsive methods, I said, well, I always knew that. That's cool, you know. And so a lot of the things that she would bring out technically or about 3D and 5D or about the hologram and the projection here, I fully understood. I knew that long, long ago. And again, it was something like there's very few people I can tell that to, but I knew I could discuss it with you because you've already heard it. You've been exposed to it. You knew it yourself.
Yeah.
And on some level, even though you claim you're not technical, I think you already knew these things, and that was partly why they were shared with you.
Yes.
So we're confirming everything all the way around. And, you know, so maybe I'm delusional and just a wannabe, as I've been called, but I don't think so.
Well, this is one of the reasons that I believe this is real, and this is one of the evidence for me, and this is what I tell people when they ask me, how do you know this is real? Because this information is mine. I know this. And of course, there are technical details of this that I don't know, because I am not scientifically oriented in this incarnation. But so many other aspects of this, it's like she's putting the pieces of the puzzle together, and the pieces I had myself all my life. I knew this, you know, and I knew some of the things even before knowing about extraterrestrials, like about the immersion program, about the holographic 3D matrix, all this. It wasn't put in these words, but I always felt that. For me, she was like reflecting back to me. The evidence that this is for real is like, this information is reflecting back to me what I already know. So I know this is real because I trust myself. I know that I am real and what I know is real. So that's why she's just reflecting it back to me. It has to be. It is real.
Right.
I don't know if I explained that well.
No, that's okay. I understood perfectly.
Okay. What do you think about the unreal people subject? How did you react to that? What knowledge do you have about that?
The unreal people and the things like the holographic projections, the fact that we're in a hologram within a hologram, that all made perfect sense. I always have known, again, since childhood, that the moon was put in place, and that I believe that it's a hollow spaceship and that they're using it for different purposes. Mm-hmm. So I think I've always known that. And I've always understood from a very early age the principles of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or Schrodinger's cat, the principle there, like the supposition of the fact that the cat can be in two different states inside a box, and you never know what state it's in until you open it and take a look at it, and then you change that and it changes the state. So you change the outcome of something simply by observing it.
Yes.
Now, that means that I always wondered as a kid or otherwise that when I left the room, does that mean that the TV or the table didn't jump out the window or they didn't disappear? I have no way of knowing that, but every time I look at it, it's there because I'm putting conscious energy and thought into it. I knew that. And as Faru was explaining that, I went, what do you know? There it is. It's like, so it's a validation for what I've always known and felt. Now, you know, there's hardly any way sometimes to explain that to your physics professor or to your college roommates or other doctors that you're involved with. It's just hard to do. So this was good for me because that's my validations.
Actually, I had a whole conversation about the cat in the room. I'm going to publish it one day. I haven't published it anywhere yet. And it's about, is the cat really there in the room? And we really had this deep conversation about this, and I was actually questioning her because I didn't understand what she meant. And the video will be called "Is the cat really there?" I mean,
yes.
In another room when you are not there.
Right.
It's an interesting topic. But now, what do you tell people who are worried about? You know, when I published this video about unreal people, about people without souls, matrix people. You know, people are worried and analyzing everybody around. How can you address that? How do you make people?
Well, yeah, I've always believed that we've had cloning technology, that we have had the ability to create androids and biological clones, if you will, for a very long time. I truly believe that for about 70 years, that technology and knowledge that people have no imagination of, way beyond Star Trek, has been kept from us. That we have the secret space programs, that there are at least four factions, and probably one that scares me to death is the Dark Fleet, because they are trafficking in human bodies, and we are considered food, we're considered meat, and we're also used for creating energy. There are certain races, I'm loath to say them out loud. We're not really supposed to talk about them, but most people know who I'm talking about, that are joined up with the Greys. And the Greys are what we call a chimera. They're a non-physical, non-souled being in most cases. They tend to be like a biological robot, and they have a kind of a hive mind mentality. And they are instructed and controlled by another race. They work, they're workers. They have very little in the way of emotions, and so they have no concept of things that they do to people if they're doing an abduction or some type of interaction. And if they're hurting a physical being, they have no concept of that either. They simply react to what they were programmed to do. Now, there are people that are like spies, or different entities that have been programmed to do things, and they're triggered. And they don't even know that they've been programmed until they're triggered to do something, and they're not even aware of it once they've been triggered. They might be triggered to murder someone or to infiltrate some group, and they have no idea that they're even doing it. So I've known about these things for a very, very long time. And again, Svaru was talking about this kind of thing, and I said, well, there's a confirmation for that. And I believe that I have interacted with that on some level. So I have actually had an abduction by the Greys and had implants and things put in me in 1986 and also of recent. And I don't want anything to do with them. They scare me to death.
Okay, this is maybe important to mention. You, before this experience, you said in the previous conversation we had privately that you had the desire go on the ship and to meet the extraterrestrials, right?
Exactly.
And you mentioned that, well, your wish was granted, but the group that met you was not necessarily benevolent. So we have to be careful what we ask for, right?
Exactly. I went through a period when I wanted to get off of this planet so bad I couldn't stand it. I missed home. I wanted to leave. I was kind of in a depression state, and I said, I want to meet the ETs no matter what, but I was not smart enough, not educated enough, not fully aware of what I was asking for, and I didn't ask for my brothers and sisters or a specific group. I just said, I want to meet the ETs. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, they took this opportunity and they jumped on that with all four. And there I was, taken aboard a craft, and they did with me as they would. And that was not fun. You know, a lot of people have been through this, so we won't reiterate what abductions are and what my lab experiences are and everything, but you must be very focused and very careful what you ask for. Now, I believe I'm protected. I know you're protected. I know they watch over us, and they're listening probably even now. But we have to make sure we invoke that protection. And we have to be careful what we open ourselves to or what we allow, and because they can take advantage of that. And they will.
Do you know why you were abducted? For what purpose? Exactly. In your case.
In 1986, it was on June 21st, the summer solstice, actually. And I had been going to a particular group that met on Friday evenings. Lots and lots of spiritual people, psychic people, healers, all different kinds of things. There were many, many times when we would call the craft, and they would come and we would see them and interact and that type of thing. And a woman came to one of the meetings that I'd never known before, never met. She came from California. And she simply walked up to me and said, I am here for you. And I said, okay. And she was a nice-looking woman and so forth, but I had no clue what it was about. And she said, you wanted to see the ships, you wanted to interact with them, I'm here to take you there. And she took me to a place in a, a park, a national park. And lo and behold, I had the experience. And it ended up that we were both taken aboard and a child was created from that particular union.
Okay. If you don't want to talk about this, we don't have to dig into
some
this.
Some of that is a little too personal.
Don't worry.
Yeah, I don't really want to get into all of that, but we were used, and they did certain genetic experiments on us that I believe resulted in a child.
But just the last question, and we can finish this off. But it was all on the physical level, or was it astral? Were you sleeping?
No, it was a physical level, but majority of that experience was wiped clean.
Okay.
And then it would start to come out in dreams and kind of like little hallucinations and things like that. And then I had, you know, the woman I kind of had contact with for a while. She had gone back to California, and she told me everything that happened, you know, because she was part of it. In what capacity, I don't know. I've never seen or heard from her again. But it was actually frightening after. It was like we were in a movie watching ourselves do something, and we had no control over what we were doing. So it was not fun. And I have a scoop hole in my left leg in front, just below the knee.
You have what? I'm sorry?
A scoop hole. Yeah, where there was a scoop of something taken out, and it's about the size of a nickel. And you can touch the skin there, but there's nothing behind it. And it's been like that since 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't have every detail of that experience. I don't even want to, I don't think. But it was uncomfortable, and I left myself open to it. So it was, I think, a lesson.
Okay.
I think it was a lesson, and they told me, you know, hey, you asked for this, you got what you asked for. So you learn really quick. Yeah.
It's definitely a lesson, because actually even if a month ago or something, we were doing the video with Robert, and we expressed how we would love to go on a ship so much, and we are expressing it openly to the public. But of course, we are very, very clear about that we want to go on a Pleiadian, Tigetan ship, you know, that we don't want to go just on any ship.
Very good.
So yeah, it's important. So, okay, so you said you incarnated here to help with the ascension, right? You were one of the first waves.
Right, right.
Do you feel you are doing what you're supposed to be doing? I kind of know the answer to the question, but... for the people?
I will answer that the best I can for you, because I came in and I thought, because I had a pretty good mind, because I was pretty smart, and I thought that I came in to do, how would I put it? I always thought that I was meant for bigger things, that I was supposed to do something grandiose to affect the world and to help humanity.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had been talking to my people about this, and I'd sit and I meditate and I tend to send the message and so forth. And they tell me, you know, that that's not always the case, that sometimes just being is enough. And then I listened to one of your interviews with Saru, and she had said that sometimes just being here is enough, that we raise the vibration of people and things around us by who we are already, and as long as we're doing our jobs of service, that that's what we're meant to do. So I kind of got the feeling, hey, you know, that's maybe where I need to fit in. Because it's kind of obvious to me at this point that I'm probably not going to change the world now. But, you know, I still hope.
But you are. But that's exactly what Varo is saying. First of all, we need to change the priorities, okay, of what's important and what's not important. She has been telling us that our priorities there, talking about the Pleiadians, are different than your priorities of importance on Earth. So what we perceive as an important task for them may not be important at all, and vice versa. And they have been stressing this point over and over again. So a simple, you know, in inverted quota, commas, a simple librarian would be doing a lot more than whoever we deem to be important on Earth. That's their words. So
right.
Keep that in mind, you know, because we have been programmed here, you know, in a reverse way in the matrix of what's important, what's not important. What the values are different from the Pleiadian perspective. So,
exactly. So
it's important to remember that. So you may be doing a lot, and you probably are, and you are. I am sure of that. And the mission,
well,
like you said, is just to be here. That's the mission, to be in the planet.
I've had a very exciting life, actually, and you know, people often ask me, well, why haven't like Harry, she was grilling me, and said, why haven't you written a book? I said, I have no desire to write a book. I have no desire to make money off of this. I have no desire to lecture other than to tell people the truth and what I know and the message of who we are, what we are, and that we should be loving one another and working together instead of concentrating on all the hate. But, you know, so I always thought that maybe I was going to be another Nikola Tesla, who was my hero, or something along those lines, but it didn't work out quite that way. But I think I have touched a few people along the way.
I'm sure you have. And actually, I would like to ask you, because you said, I just want to share what I know and the message. So, okay, so what do you know? Like, what is your message? What is Dale Harder's message right now? Talk to you from your Pleiadian soul right now.
Well, my message is to all of humanity, you know, that we need to stop concentrating on the false news. We need to stop thinking about all the wars, all the destruction. We need to stop concentrating on all of the kind of things that are thrown at us on a daily basis. Because those that are in charge, the cabal, the reptilian, they very much are in a war with our brothers and sisters and other ET races that are here, that are doing everything they can to free humanity and to give us the opportunity to experience all the technology that we've missed out on and to take our rightful place through ascension to 5D and above so that we can become part of the universe as we should have been almost 100 years ago. The way that they keep us negative and keep these races that are controlling the earth, they depend on negativity to survive. Not only do they eat humans physically and treat us like cattle, they also subsist on our energy, especially our emotional energy, And humans are fantastic creators. Okay, we've been called the gods before, but you know, we're not God, but we are very able to create what we think. And therefore, what we focus on, what we think about on a daily basis is what we're creating. And if they're giving us negativity to think about, we're proliferating that state, and we cannot ascend. So we need to learn how to let go of that, how to let go of karma, and stop the wheel of reincarnation, and be able to ascend and to bring the entire planet, which is in ascension also, because Mother Earth, or Gaia, Terra, is a living entity. She is also in ascension, and she's going to ascend now whether we want her to or not. She has to. She has waited as long as she possibly can for humanity to catch up. Okay, so some of us here are ready, and some will ascend by choice. Others that can't accept it, all I would say to them is, I love you, but I'm sorry. If you can't accept it, you're going to have to leave, and they will. Now, people will probably think of that as, oh, they perished and they're gone, they're not going to die. They'll simply go to another place and continue where they are as those beings of that level of energy. But for the rest of us, hey, come on, it's time. We have to move on. And I think that overall, that humanity is ready for the truth. We are ready to ascend. We are ready to have disclosure. We are ready to take our rightful place. And that means to let go of this negativity that is perpetrated upon us every single day and every minute of our lives. So the only way that's going to happen is if we stop focusing on that, acknowledge it. And as I tell the reptilian or the grays, there are different races that are involved, and some of them are good or have made the transition and are fighting for the good. But at this point in time, and I'm not being racist or categorizing everybody as the same, but I simply tell them I don't wish to interact with them and that I will love them from afar. Okay? So you guys, if you stay over here, I'll love you from afar and I interact with the rest. Because I don't have time to sort it out. My time here is limited. If I were after the ascension, I got all the time in the universe. But not now. So this is what we need to do. We got to get out of the Babylonian money magic system, which again is something that's been perpetrated upon us. We have to release all of that because we're held in a daily life of eat, sleep, work, eat, sleep, work. We have no chance to do the things that humanity should do. And once we can get to that point and we see the truth, then things are going to change very, very rapidly. And I believe I've been told that from my contact with Palladium that essentially they will allow us to destroy ourselves with nukes or different things like that if we must. And partly because of free will and the non-interference directive. But if we get to the point where we're going to damage the planet irreparably or harm any of the solar system or other stars that we interact with, then they may take action, and if they had to, they'd wipe us out. And I fully understand that. I think that's the only choice. So that wouldn't surprise me. But they will not act unless we ask them to. And we've got to reach what I call critical mass. Critical mass is when enough beings on this planet realize that we need help and ask for it. Then our brothers and sisters can step in and help us. But not until.
Well, this is very interesting about asking for help. Well, my opinion on this is that, they have been helping in many, many, many ways, but they will, I understand what you mean. They will not help more directly if we are not going to help. And you know what, actually, I will tell you that I have a YouTube channel that is separate to my channels, the Cosmic Agency channels. It's called, in Spanish, it's called The Call from the Planet Earth. And a few months ago, I made the campaign asking people to make short videos in which they express themselves asking the benevolent extraterrestrials for help. And if you go to this channel, I will send you the link. It's mostly in Spanish. I have about 200 videos of individual people with their amateur videos, and it's very touching, some of them. You know, simple looking,
people
asking the extraterrestrials for help, because actually it was my idea together with Varu. She also mentioned that. She said it's very crucial that humanity openly asks for help. And it's not just Tibetans and the Federations that are listening, but other races, they are all listening, and they you know, by the laws, Prime Directive and other laws, they cannot take any further action if there is not a specific mass of people asking for their intervention. So I made this channel. I will send you a link. It's very interesting what you do.
Awesome. Good.
Okay. And just before I go to the next question, I have just this question. Do you remember anything else about your Pleiadian life? You did mention the training. Anything else? Any details about the society? Because I'm going to have a video coming up about the Tibetan society. Three parts of this. So it may trigger your memories about how they live and structure of their whole society, the education, the politics. You know, they don't have politics. How they do that, the animals, their houses, architecture. I don't have any pictures, by the way, but I'm going to publish the information. So do you have any details?
I have some memories of like family and interaction and so forth. People ask me how old I was. The Palladian lived considerably longer than Earthling. I have been told that they could live as much as 1,200 years, but it's not unusual. There's been also reports that say 900, 950, that kind of thing. I know that I was considerably older. I know that I had a wife and I had children, but it's not the kind of association that we have here. A man and a woman get married and they're in a little family unit and so forth, and children, while we do have children, I believe, in the Pleiades, there's not that, they're done with purpose and at a particular time or a need for the community, but it is not like we just willy-nilly get together and pop out kids. You know, we don't just kind of do that. Children are very, very well educated. And a young child of 9 or 10 years of age there would best any of the smartest scientists we have on the planet. So I know that that is true. What others don't realize is that when you reach 5D or above, that every thought that you have is known by everyone else instantaneously. There is no lying. Okay, no keeping secrets from each other, and that we are creative in the ability to do anything instantly, instantaneously, so that we must have absolute control over our heart, our minds, and our thoughts, because we could cause harm. And so it's a great leap to come from the 3D to the 5.
Yes.
And that's why humanity needs to learn and prepare to get to that point. I couldn't tell you that even I'm able to do that at this point. I don't think I could, but I'm aware of it. And it takes a lot of effort. It's kind of like if you were to meet ETs, for example, and they were around you. Most of the ETs out there are telepathic. They react to and feel emotions very strongly. And some of them... And I'm going to borrow an instance from Emery Smith, because I think it's apropos. As he explained one of his times of experience, and I also relate to this, is that certain ETs have different smells, they have different bodily functions as we have, and he was relaying an instance, I laughed really hard, he was relaying an instance in which an ET had a particular smell, which was really, by our terms, horrific. Okay, and he said that he thought for just a moment that, oh, the smell is just unbearable. And the ET next to him, two people away, he said, picked up on this instantly. And they knew, and you could see on their face that they knew what he had thought, and he slipped in his protocol. And so they have this, you know, they know something almost as we know it, instantaneously. So one must be very, very careful to maintain love, gratitude, happiness, and interaction. And our emotions are what they pick up on the most. So when I go out and I try to call the ships to come in, if I've had a really rough day or I'm down or I'm upset, they're not going to come because that emotion is the first thing that slaps them in the face, and they can't take that. They're very open, they're very loving, and they're very happy, and our negative emotions come across as a hit in the face.
Yeah, so, it's true.
Yeah, they back away. They back away from that. So we have to be very, very careful to try and control those emotions. We're some of the most emotional creatures in the universe. And, you know, so our emotions are so strong that in some systems, some planetary systems, it's even considered to be a disease, a contagious disease. So I've heard. So, you know, it's quite a thing. We are presented with the opportunity and sometimes the misfortune of having to experience really difficult emotions on this planet on a daily basis. And how we react to those is part of the lesson that we're here to learn, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's part of the whole thing. But if I'm in a very good mood, I've had a great day, I'm really happy, and I go out and I ask them to come, generally within 5 minutes they'll show up. And that's really cool, you know. So, although, like I said, because of where I am, I don't think they can land. I mean, they're certainly not right between the houses or anything, you know. But they do come close, and they do interact. And there are times when I get very, very strong impressions. There are times when I get voices that literally come through, and. You know, so it's and there are times when I will use a laser, and I say this very cautiously, because lasers are dangerous tools if they're not properly used, and anybody shining one in the sky, if there's an airplane anywhere in the sky, kick their butt if I caught them, it's a very dangerous thing to do. But under certain circumstances, a laser is permissible to use as a tool to signal a ship. And they will respond to that. They'll flash and they'll light up and they will respond. So you know darn well you're not looking at a meteor. You know you're not watching, you know, some satellite go across because they don't respond with flashes. Sometimes the ships will power up extremely bright and just hang there. And then they'll slowly dim down. And you can see the ship and then they go away a little bit. And then you'll flash and they'll flash again. And it's amazing, you know, to see.
Let's just clarify this because you are a laser expert, right? So you
yes,
know everything about lasers. So what is the safe way to signal at the ship?
Well, I believe that it is rude to shoot a laser directly at the ship.
But can you see?
You can go around it, or you can pulse the light toward them, but not at the ship. That's like hitting somebody in the face.
But can they really see it from that distance? Because I
always
thought I'm too far. No,
The lasers that are available today, the little handheld lasers, they will do quite a bit of power. And they're powerful enough to blind pilots and people while flying aircraft. And the ships out there are so sensitive to this stuff, they can easily see it. They sense it. They know it's there instantly. And they will respond. But like I said, there is some etiquette to it. Do not continuously blast a laser at a ship and hit the ship. That's just not right to do.
So how should
but
we do
short, that? Short pulses, like you're sending a little hello, how are you kind of thing, that's okay. And I have used that on occasion. Now, there are other times when I will simply talk to them, and if there's other people around me, for the benefit of those people, I will speak out loud and tell them what I'm saying to the ship, and the ship will respond to me telepathically, and they see it. they'll flash at the same time. So they do it in different ways. And, you know, so it's...
A specific laser that you would recommend, or just any laser would do?
Well, what they are typically is they're little handheld solid-state lasers that are available in different markets. In the United States, it's actually against the law to have one that puts out more than 5 milliwatts, but they are available through various sources that will do 100, 200, even several watts of power. And as I said, those are very dangerous tools. They're created for scientific purposes, but people tend to take that to the extremes, and they want to do nasty things with them.
Mm-hmm.
So and that is something that I'm not condoning that. I don't recommend it, and I certainly wouldn't want to see somebody do something to harm an animal or an aircraft or anything like that. I would get very upset if I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
It's not like I'm not telling everybody to go out there, run right out and get a laser and shoot at the ship. I'm not recommending that at all.
Yeah, I have to tell Robert about this. Actually, this is something that he is very much interested in. He has some lasers, and we have done some signaling. So I will forward this information to him. Now I have two major questions, and then maybe we can finish if you want. But I have this interesting curiosity to share with people still. That, you know, your meeting with Von Braun. I know it's you've talked about this many times.
Yeah,
probably,
yeah.
But it's something very interesting, very curious, because Von Braun is very well known. So it's very, very fascinating to know someone who talked to him, because you actually spoke to him a few times.
Right.
Let me just share with the people a few sentences about who he is. How do you say his name? Werner Von Braun, or Werner in English.
No, this is Werner Von Braun.
Werner, because it's German. So he's German-American aerospace engineer and space architect, a leading figure in the development of rocket technology in Nazi Germany, and a pioneer of rocket technology and space science in the United States, secretly moved there along with other 1,600 German scientists, technicians, and other people. So under the paperclip program. So he was involved with rocket development under Nazi Germany and later on United States. And you spoke anything that you want to add to what he did?
Well, he was an SS officer, even though he was head of the German rocket program. And he worked with Hermann Oberth, who was his right-hand man. He was brought here, as you say, on Project Paperclip. I have some particular doubts about, personal doubts that you and I can discuss later, but he was the father of the rocket program for the Germans during the war. He was responsible for the V-2, the V-1, and the V-12, and a few other programs. When he was brought here, he was brought to White Sands in New Mexico. And essentially, after the war, we captured many of the V-2 rocket and brought them here. And I also have reason to believe that the anti-gravity craft that were called Hanabu may have been brought here, or at least parts of them, and that some of that research was continued there. I had the occasion to meet him at two separate lectures, and one was in 1970, which was held at NASA, and the other was in 1973, which was at the University of Akron. And after the show, people gathered around, got to talk to him a little bit, and I got to introduce myself and talk to him a few minutes, and, you know, so each time, I even asked him myself the same classic question that many have said they've asked, how did you do what you did? And he said that they had help. And I said, who helped you? And he said, he just looked up.
But he didn't say who. He didn't say what positive, negative.
He just looked up and indicated like them. And that was all he said.
Wow.
But he wouldn't really, you know, he was being cryptic, of course. But we always suspected that anyway. You don't. You know, the Germans were probably 25 years in advance of the technology of the United States at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was some real, very interesting things going on there.
You know, you're going to enjoy one of my next videos. It's actually Rachel revealing their connection with real society.
Okay.
So they will talk about that, and actually they are talking about how it's actually them, but it will be explained how, who went back in time and assisted the Germany at the time with the development of some of their craft. But it's because they, well, they, she's explaining they were trying to deal with them. They were offering some technology in exchange for them stopping their nuclear programs or something like that.
Right.
So so they actually went back in time because it's kind of complicated. It will be explained in the video. They went back in time because actually, now brace yourself for this information. I think I said that in one of the videos. Rachel is the girl who contacted Eisenhower. So when they failed with the Eisenhower, the next operation was to go back in time to the before the war and negotiate something with the Nazi Germany. But that was then, and later on they were misinterpreted as a negative group, the real society, Maria Orsic and all that. But actually it was them, but the information was later distorted. They were not actually trying to give the Nazi any technology. They was just trying to negotiate certain things with them. It will be explained in the video, but it's an interesting piece of information.
On the note regarding that, myself, and I'm only speaking for myself, is that personally I have always felt, and I have some proof, but not enough, and I'm looking for more, but I have always felt that the Germans had nuclear bomb capability before the end of the war. The difficulty was that they had no way to deliver it. And I certainly believe that they had that. There's a few inconsistencies, even with the United States having developed the bomb and delivering it to Japan. Some of the information just doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
So I have always felt that there's something that's definitely rotten in there,
yeah,
kind of thing.
There's something there going on.
Something not right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what this new video that I will publish about this, if it can give you any more pieces of the puzzle. The sad thing is that we were supposed to continue talking about this with her, with Rachel, and she was supposed to give us more information about this. It was like an introduction, but then they disappeared. So for now, we cannot continue with the subject. But going back to the Von Braun, you said in the interview that I saw with Kerry Cassidy that you didn't have a good feeling about him.
That, again, and this is just my personal opinion.
Okay, yes.
Is that I always felt that there was something somewhat negative about the man. He did very well to present himself to the United States as the head of our program and to advocate space travel and to make space stations and all the different things. But I suspect or felt that there was still some negativity there, and that perhaps once an SS agent, maybe always an SS agent.
Okay.
All right. Now, again, as I said, that's strictly my opinion. I have no proof of that. But it's the kind of thing that when you meet certain people, you have feelings that somehow you can't ignore.
Yes.
And so I would never, ever say, oh, anybody's just negative, but I had that feeling from him.
Yes, yes. Okay, very well. Now, you mentioned that you had the message to share with the people, and you shared some of this message throughout this video. You expressed what you know and what you would like people to know in this time. But now, Dale, it's your opportunity to actually do something different this time, to do something the opposite. What would you like to say to the Pleiadian families listening to you at this moment? Because for sure they are listening. So now forget the message to the humanity. What would be your message to the Pleiadians right now, to your crew, to our crew, if that's true that I'm Pleiadian too?
I miss you.
I miss you too.
Honest, I really do. I miss my family. And I would do just about anything that, of course, as long as it didn't harm anyone, but I'd do just about anything for myself to just sit and talk with them for a while, to get that little bit of recharge of energy just to keep going, you know. And it's like when we talk, we kind of recharge one another, and it gives us a little energy to keep going. That's what I would like. You know, I really don't need much more than that. And I would ask just one thing of my family, and that is, even though I'm here to serve and to serve selflessly, and I truly believe what I say, and I make an effort every single minute of every day to do that, there's one thing that I would like, and that is, before I leave, I would like to be able to experience just a little bit of humanity's ascension and to see humanity take its rightful place,
mm-hmm.
and experience that.
Yes.
And if I experience a little bit of that, then I could say I've done my job and I feel good about it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's all I really need. So otherwise, I'm content. Life is wonderful. The earth is a fantastic place. Then the diversity of life and everything here is just amazing. And sure, life can be difficult sometimes for all of us. On a daily basis, we have to fight. But that, again, is being perpetrated upon us, and we can rise above that if we choose and remember that that's all just a hologram. It's all just a program.
A game.
Okay, it's a game. Exactly right. And so, you know, and sometimes that's really hard. It is. And for every single one of us. So, I'm not saying that everything's all wonderful and wine and roses and that slip on your rose-colored glasses. I'm not that foolish. But, you know, a lot of it is about the attitude. Hey, I have my personal health issues and things to fight with on a daily basis. But I won't ever give in. Never. I'll go to my grave never giving in. I've been here that long and I'm going to keep on. So I think that we all can do that, and we all have to do that. We are in the last hour, the last minutes before we make that leap. And, so it's important now more than ever. So those are my only desires, my only needs, really. To see them, meet with them, that would be the greatest gift of all.
Yes.
Now, for me personally, and to your audience, meeting you and the job that you're doing has done a lot toward that effort. And so I applaud you and thank you for doing that.
Thank you, and thank you for your words. And I know I feel the same. I feel the same. I've always wanted just to be in their presence. And
yeah.
Not much, just like, please let me be in your presence. So and people sometimes ask me, why do you need that? For what? We don't need anything to be content and happy and all that, you know? But no, I just feel like it would bring me closer to my identity, that the forgotten identity that I feel deep inside. It's like I am something to myself that I can't fully recognize. So being in their presence, I feel, would activate my own identity, and I'll be, you know, the sense of home. And that's one. I always wanted that. And the same, I always wanted the humanity I want to observe the humans participate in the liberation. Like, I want to see them liberated, at least some of them. I know not all of them will happen at the same time, but I want to see their essence, their light, and their full activated version of themselves. You know, I want to see the spark liberated, because I know it's there. It's just being so suppressed and manipulated, and it makes me, I have so much compassion, you know, for that spark being suppressed. Even though Zvaru always has been telling us, now everybody is where everybody always is at the situation, the place that corresponds to their frequency. So I don't feel too bad, because everybody is where they are supposed to be, yes. But at the same time, both of us, them and us, are trying to help liberate the suppressed spark. So I would love to see that happen in my lifetime as well, at least
Right.
some of it. And yes, if what
Well,
we...
it's like I believe that you have experienced this, and I also is I have been on the ship, and one of them was not that long ago, within the last 6 months. But I had an extreme lucid dream, coming out of that lucid dream, I could feel, I could hear, I could touch. I knew I was on the ship. I had been working with them. We were doing something, and it was for many hours. And for me, I don't sleep more than 20 minutes at a time. I rarely get any rest. But this one was definite. And they let me remember a little of it, and then it quickly faded. But they claim that if we go to the ship, if we are allowed to experience what we really are, that we would enjoy it so much that we might not want to come back.
That's what Maru told us.
Yes,
she says,
yes,
no,
yes.
We can't let you come in. Because
that makes perfect sense.
Yes, she says, you can't, because if you come in here, even for 1 minute, because I told her, just let me see it for like 10 seconds. She says, no, because you will perceive the reality in its full awakened state, and you will perceive yourself in that state, and you will not want to go back ever.
Right.
Even though I was trying to tell her, no, I will want to come back, because I was, okay, look at this way. We were already there, right? So even though we will go back and we will remember, I'm like, oh, it's wonderful, but we were there already. So it's like getting our memory back. But we will also remember the task, right? Because we came here on purpose. So we will remember that we had the task. And we will feel maybe the task is not finished. So we will want to continue to go. We will want to go back. You know what I mean?
I can understand. You know, the temptation would be very great to want to stay.
But I mean, I will want to come back here, because I will feel my task is not finished. And she said, you know how she responded? No, you will know that your task has finished, and then you will not want to go back. I said, so my task is finished? I remember we had this conversation one time, and she said, yes, your task is already being realized. And I was telling her, I feel there's more to be done, you know. But this is where we have to be careful. This is where she talks about this in a subject of karma and reincarnation, because we always want to repair something or do more. And this is what ties at least the human souls. The star seeds have a bit different process, but the human souls always want to go back because they always feel they are not adequate enough. And they want to do more. They want to go back, repair things. And this is what ties you back to the wheel of the reincarnation. And she always says, you are perfect as you are. You are doing great. You are doing what you're supposed to be doing. There's no need to be stressing over, I have to do more and repair, you know, whatever. But at the same time, the star seeds, as she said, have a different system. And we actually have some kind of a Teflon cover. She explained that, Teflon cover. So we don't get trapped by the wheels of karma on the way out. So we will go back. We will not be sucked in, from what I understand.
Stay away from the white light.
Stay away from the white light. Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's a trap.
Okay.
You're poked into the reincarnation thing with the reptilian group again, and you keep coming back and keep coming back. When I leave, I'm going to go home.
Were you a man as a Pleiadian man, or do you remember that?
I remember being, I believe I was masculine, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although I've had other lives and stuff, other things that I've done here too, but you know, it's not my first rodeo.
You have a partner. You said a wife, so you have a family to go back to.
Yeah. Perhaps. You know, I mean, they're doing their thing too. You know, they're not sitting stagnant.
Yeah.
They may very well be on missions and doing things as well. So, you know, that's what we do. We volunteer and we take care of these kind of things. And it's because I believe we all have a sincere desire to give and to help. And the more that we do that, the more we want to do that. It's a self-fulfilling thing.
Yeah.
you know, but it just happens, I think, to be on the more positive side.
Our whole life here may feel, when you go back, it will be like a year when it went by. So you will, you will wake up in from maybe from that immersion program. And Svaru told us once that if we the star seeds that are in this immersion program, if you wake up, when you wake up there, there's going to be maybe Aneka or someone on the other side saying hello. How did you like the program? And it's going to be like a few months went by or a year or it depends. Because the time is so different there.
That immersion program made me just think for a moment. Another curious thing that I did when I was a child that I mentioned real quick is that I always believed and said to myself that I never worried about dying because I knew that I am me, okay? And that if I died, that there will always be someone else who will come along and say, I am me. And in the act of doing that, that would be me doing that.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Okay, so try to understand this concept when you're 5 years old. You know, it's like, okay, so, but I always had that kind of a feeling. And what I was really trying to say was that as long as there's somebody that's going to say that they're me, I would always be there. Wow. And I didn't have any idea why I knew that or understood it, but I did.
And the other you would be your also your other version of you.
I would simply still be me, you know, and as long as someone was able to say that, I'd still be me.
Okay.
Because I think if I left this life now, my only hope would be that I could remember who I was this life and what I did.
Yes.
I don't like the forgetting part.
No.
And I want to remember, you know. People say that when you die, you're going to go to heaven and you're going to be judged. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think that we're going to judge ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need anybody to judge me. God knows I know what I did wrong. And maybe what I did right, too.
This is what this new video is about. You have to watch it. I published it today. It's just a half an hour, and it's about karma. And it explains all that, and about the wheels of karma. Because Baru actually doesn't believe in karma as it is understood.
So, right, and that's what people need to learn now also, is about forgiving their karma, letting it go, and releasing karma altogether so that they can ascend. People think karma's forever, and it is, unless you let it go.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. This is Valu's words. You're going to love it.
Right.
You'll see.
You have to let go of karma.
Yeah.
And so that's another lesson that we have to learn. So taking everything, putting it on the table, forgiving yourself for any instance whatsoever, accepting it, and moving forward, that releases you from all of that, and then you can concentrate on the better things. And, you know, so many people are so hung up on, I had a fight with so-and-so, and I'm going to get even no matter what, and it poisons their soul, you know, or money or possessions or whatever, and they're nothing. They're just nothing. They mean nothing. The older I get, the less I care about all the stuff. It's only the heart, the love, the feelings, those are the things that you'll take with you. I have many friends, and some that are very, very wealthy. And one of the things that I have always said to them and proved my point was that no matter what you do when you die, you're not going to put everything in a U-Haul and carry it behind your hearse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen. On a couple of times, I was sitting at lunch with one that was very wealthy, and he couldn't decide about certain things that was going to cost them a great deal of money. I mean, millions. And I said, look, I said, if you die, you can't take it with you. You're not going to put it in a hearse. And he dropped his fork in his food, and he looked at me dumbfounded and said, you're absolutely right. And he went and took care of the problem, and he's been happy ever since. So, you know, it's all in how you look at that. Half a loaf is better than none.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Dale, thank you very much. I feel like this the second half of this interview was more like me chatting with you, like with a friend, than an interview. So sorry about that. I was getting carried away, just sharing my own what I know. I hope it didn't bother you.
Not at all.
Okay.
As long as it helps everybody out there, that's all I care about. If any of your listeners have questions, please tell them. I'll answer if I can.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes. Any final words, maybe, perhaps?
I have a story that I'm going to share with you after we get off the line. You could always tell it if you like, but it's a very emotional story for me, and it has to do with some of the pictures that I sent you.
Okay. All right. So let's just finish here. I'm going to see if it got saved. Oh my God! Imagine that it's not saved.
Well, I hope it does. But if we didn't, we'll talk again.
Yeah, but no, I hope it's still recording. So thank you very much, Dale. Thank
you. My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you everybody for watching. Bye bye. Bye bye.